So this week on Spotlight on Art, we've got a second guest. We're spoiling ourselves this week. We've got Jaz Singh. He's joining myself and Rob Watson. So Jaz, welcome.
Thank you.
Cool. So give us an introduction then. So Jaz Singh, digital tool artist, give us an overview. How would you introduce yourself to someone normally?
Yeah, so there's two parts of being Jaz Singh. There's Jaz Singh who does one particular piece of one terms of sort of artwork, which is sort of more based on me in a sense. And then there's a sort of a pseudo thing, which is Sabotage, which is I do that as part of a performance thing where I'm sort of balaclavaed up and do live visual and audio immersive sounds and visual sounds. But the good thing with that is it's easier to work with people because I don't really have that many skill sets in terms of tech. So that way I can bring people in who are interested in doing it.
That you can collaborate with.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I can collaborate and don't really have to do as much as I'd like to do.
So now we've collaborated a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about your 1984 exhibition last year at the Phoenix, and also the Computala exhibition that we did earlier where you kind of collaborated with me, which has been great. So we've had a sort of mutual collaboration. But tell me, what's, you know, the first one, the sort of the Jaz Singh you,
yes,
what sort of thing does that involve you creating?
It's in a sense sort of self help therapy, or sort of finding myself and where I'm at, and it's largely due to moving back to Leicester and being around my family. And sort of seeing and observing another part of me that I didn't really realise. So, excuse me, but for example, for the 1984 project, it sort of started from like me going down to see my parents, and like ritualistically, like at 5:30, the TV's on, and they're praying to a TV screen, and I'm thinking, without swearing, why is this happening?
Because one of the very first conversations we had was about your dad and his engagement with the TV was very much like my dear old dad, which was, you know, I mean, he would always be like shouting at someone on Sky News or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And and it just started from that. And then I started to think about, because it's 40 years since the 1984 conflict, and I started to sort of look at myself and started to sort of relate to it in the sense of how has that influenced my work, and why did I have this sort of strong connection towards trying to expose it or trying to make some piece of work around it. But a lot of the sort of centenary things that were based on the 40th anniversary was, I kept thinking, because everyone kept thinking God, and I kept thinking gold, oil and drugs in my sense, you know, sort of, but then sort of started to realise that how people are sort of, I mean, when people, you know, activists and so forth, people are always talking about injustices or whatever. I just kept thinking, Diego Maradona, and, you know, sort of adverts or He-Man.
So you're always thinking back to 1984, and then the artwork specifically, wasn't it, or the installation at the Phoenix was about Operation Blue Star, which was sort of, you know, the retaking by the Indian Army of Amritsar, the Golden Temple.
Yeah.
So you've got this vivid memory as a child of 1984, seeing it play out on the television, but you've also got this vivid memory of everything else of that age in popular culture, which is football, music, and all
TV,
this sort of stuff. And it's how people remember, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was the main thing with the... I mean, I came to you when I was saying... when I asked my dad, I was like... Because my vivid memory of... The sort of invasion of 1984 at Amritsar was a tank being sort of penetrating the front of the Golden Temple. And then it just went down the rabbit hole of not being able to source that material.
And we still can't find it.
No, it's a conspiracy. It's a huge conspiracy. But it then started to, which sort of started to make me think about, well, if I can't find that, let's say, is that sort of, you know, people... Yeah, you could class it as a genetic memory or sort of, you know, sort of the Mandela effect or whatever it is. But then I thought, well, I'm not going to... I'm getting slightly bored of trying to source this material. How would the viewer find it? I mean, great, I found this material. And everyone would be like, yeah, great. Did you see it? No. Why? Because I have no interest in it. So it then starts to sort of evolve in the sense of like, how does that, my influence of, it, well, me being around in 1984, how does that reconnect with a lot of people? And that was having conversations with yourself and your background and knowledge. And then starting to think, well, actually, if I just try to do as much as I can within the sort of, so how I sort of create work, it's, I mean, what do you call it? You know, it's, I suppose it's video journalism in a sense. I mean, if that's a word to use, and just sourcing, collecting various materials and then just splicing them up. And it sort of derives from this sort of attention span that we all have, which is, you know, the scrolling effects, if that's a word. Yeah.
So now with the exhibition at the Phoenix 1984, you went in, it was quite a dark space and you could hear the noise. And then you had to walk around the installation that had been built to these three television sets showing three different films that you'd made, but all with imagery that people would recognise. And for my age, for example, I recognise a lot of that imagery. Different people, different characters, famous people, different things, adverts and stuff. What are you trying to do, do you think, when you're doing your installation? Are you looking to shock? Are you looking to provoke? Are you trying to get people to almost like challenge themselves to either engage with it or challenge themselves to leave because they're not interested?
Yeah, I mean, the conscious sort of... So the way I sort of create it, it's not only just the TV screens in a sense, it is from the moment you walk through the door. And so, you know, the Phoenix is, I mean, it's quite a large space in a sense. When I went to see the venue previously, I saw the exhibitions and it was all emphasized on wall based because, oh, there's two projectors, we've got loads of space, let's just project as large as we can. And I thought, well, that's not the relationship I've got with TVs, especially from the 80s. I mean, I think...
Well, all TVs were small.
Yeah, they were small on a stand, on, yeah. Towards, you know, sort of nearest to the floor in a sense. So the whole sort of idea of hearing before you see it, and I mean, I did a previous exhibition where you could turn them on, they'll turn on with sensors depending on where you walked, but I thought, well, so the three TV sets are, they're of a particular era. So you start with the 80s and 90s and then the, I don't know, is it called noughties or 2000s in a sense, what I call it. And then someone said to me, what happened in between? It's like, well, I had an head injury, so I don't really remember the rest of it. So I'll be fabricating it. So the idea of walking into the space and I'm forcing somebody... My idea, it's not a foolproof method, I've not done any sort of intense research on it, but it's how people walk around exhibitions, and it's to make it into a personal feeling, so all the audio's on and all the visuals are on simultaneously, but you can never get an overview of all three of the TVs on when you walk back. It's impossible. And the point is, neither do I. I don't get it myself.
Yeah, because you couldn't actually retreat back where you could see all three screens. It was very much around. You could see one, possibly some of the second one, but there was always a third one that you're unaware of. What I liked was when we were first talking about putting the exhibition together, it was the complete opposite of let's project onto every wall and make use of the space. It was have these three focal points, these televisions, quite small, so you almost had to pay attention. You couldn't just casually take in what was going on. And you almost lost how big the space was where you were actually viewing it. So from my perspective, it reminded me very much, you know, when you watch some of these old programs and when they want to give you a sense of an out-of-body experience, or you're having some kind of like spiritual thing or on a different dimensional plane, it'd be some person sitting there on a plane floor and it'd just be a big white box. It kind of gave me that feeling. You had to be there in order to kind of sense it. Is that what you were trying to create with with this particular piece of art?
Yeah, well, I never really thought in that sense. I think it was almost, I mean, I was just thinking what you said just a second before. If I go to, well, I'm going to try and be sort of conservative. Let's say 90% of anybody's living room now, there'd be a humongous screen somewhere, the interior design, should I call it, will be based around the TV, whether it's against the wall or it's in the corner. the sofa would be situated, and it'd be quite a minimalistic sort of sense. Whereas when I was being brought up, and I'm sure when we were all being brought up, the TV was there because everyone has to have
it. Was
TV.
The focal point, wasn't it?
Yeah, but then we still had flowery lino, and you know, we still had sort of particular things based around that. I don't think as human beings we had we'd evolved into forcing ourselves staring at the black mirror in a sense. Whereas, dependent, well, obviously because of technology, I was sort of trying to emphasize exactly what you just said. It was in, I experienced those visuals on those particular screens, and I was trying to reminisce and try to get it as visually, let's say, accurate as the feeling that I wanted, and I wanted other people to experience that, basically, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about a sort of an exhibit and a museum part, because the next thing that we moved on to after supporting you with 1984 and a little bit of knowledge, and we were talking about, you know, exhibits and drawing on different things. You didn't want it to be a documentary, for example, which I think it would have been if you projected onto the wall. We collaborated on something earlier this year called Computala here at LCB, and that was me getting out the sort of some items, ephemera from Citizen's Eye from 2008 to 2014, yeah. Putting together like a traditional exhibit, if you like, and then getting out five films from our archive of our 1,200 films, and then you interpreted each one in your own unique way of almost like making it contemporary and up to date. How much of a challenge was that for you in a way of working differently from what you normally do?
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I don't really change the way I work, but and so
I really thought I was challenging you. I've discovered I wasn't challenging you at all.
No. In the sense of it wasn't new to me. It was it's sort of like I have conversations with yourself. I have conversations, and then it's what I take from the conversation. So excuse me. So, but I do have to say that Jedi mind trick that you did, where it was like I was looking at it structurally with the what do you call it? The library. You know, the five videos that you initially sent. Yeah. And but if I went sort of chronologically, went do video 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, it's not going to happen.
Don't work that way.
No. Yeah. So just pick the one that I want to use first, which, so I have an interest in the, when you were talking about how journalism is or will be changing, and, will people be sort of just doing it from their lounge, which in a sense people do with social media and all these sort of keyboard warriors in a sense. And I was looking at the sort of historical facts of mobile phones and how that sort of changed the way we live our lives for the last 20, 25 years. I mean, let's not forget, I mean, there's been a lot of suicide bombings through it, but there's been a lot of great things with connectivity with people not being able to do stuff. But I was sort of trying to look at it in a particular way where I would have done that. But then the only one which I found frustratingly challenging, if that's a word I'd like to,
yeah, good, tell me about that one,
yeah. And that was the radio one when you were talking about those, the five ones that you were talking about. I can't remember what they're about, the children, the elderly, and all that. And I was like, hang on. And it was there's a segment when you were talking about you have to, you know, for the radio show, you have to do this for the people who are sponsoring you. And I thought, well, that's what it is, it's just an advert. So it just became far easier for me to do so. But that's something I would not have necessarily have done previously.
Because normally you'd have an idea or a thought about what you'd want to do. You'd then go off and find the source material. Whereas what we were looking to do with Computala was create, we already had a body of material, and then it was selecting. And I said to you, I think these five, and actually we're going with these because these are the sort of the beginnings of Citizen's Eye.
Yeah.
So it's actually kind of working in a slightly different way. But your process works, doesn't it? What you do, you were still able to create what I would call sort of, you know, jazzing.
Yeah, and I had a great excuse because I could actually talk about human trafficking and blame it all on you. You know, which is a great thing about it.
I've got broad shoulders, mate. You know what I mean? I've got broad shoulders.
But that's something I'm pursuing now anyway. Not getting involved in and seeing how you make the money out. But it's it became a new subject matter that I hadn't necessarily, I would not have sort of looked upon, because I would have thought, well, I ain't got any kids, I don't really care. As in, when I make the work, and normally make work, I make work that concerns me, but then that's the only one that still grates me when I start to look into it. And it was just like, and having a conversation, I was like, and people are like, we call that empathy, Jess. Is that what I'm feeling? Mm. I'm actually feeling something and give a bleep, bleep, bleep thing about
so. So do you think your head injury has changed, well, obviously changed who you are, but also changed the way that you're creative?
Yeah, I've got no choice. Well, we have choices. I mean, I used to make large, you know, climb up a ladder, one leg on the ladder, trying to be acrobatic, let's say, when I just make my work. But it's a lot of it's become visual. It's within my sort of amenities, how I can sort of create things, which is great, because I'm still allowed and able to do it, which is down to going through headway, you know, the sort of head injury place.
So we're here on Spotlight on Arts, myself, John Costa, and Rob Watson. And we're here this week with Jazz Singh, who's talking to us about his practice. Now, Jazz, how you've described yourself earlier as, you know, that sort of...
6 foot blonde.
Yeah, absolutely. Took the words right out of my... You took the words right out of my list that I've got here.
When
you look back to sort of a younger self, your younger self, I mean, as in, you know, when you were doing something that was maybe creative or you were interested in or anything that you felt was sort of arty or anything like that, would you have imagined that you'd be doing this kind of content now? I mean, obviously, you weren't planning on the head injury, but I'm saying, is it still very similar to what you were interested in when you were at school or when you were inspired in art or creativity?
Yeah, it's always been... it's always like... What happens to me, it's like I'm constantly scanning things and I'm trying to see how can I make that with the... How can I make that plastic cup, let's say, for example, relate to this? Is that a strawberry? A strawberry sort of textile thing. And that's the only thing that's going on within my mind. I always remember the time when we had two pieces of wood and I was really, really young. One of the first memories. I'm great with long-term memory, short-term memory, not the great. And all I wanted to do was glue this small bit of chunk onto the larger one to turn it into a boat visually so it looks like a boat. There's no glue. I don't know what glue is. So it's like, how do you join these things without it? So every time I'm trying to push it as a child on the floor, well, I was slightly older then, but it kept falling off and it would be... How can I make two things relate? So it's always to do with the medium and how can I sort of connect them in a way where they don't fall off. I mean, the worst thing I see is when I go to an exhibition, it's like, oh, well, that's a bit bent. Like, why have you used that material? Why have you just used a nail? You know, or screwed something in.
So are you like constantly analysing all the time?
Yeah, I can't help it.
Yeah.
But I see it as it's just what I do. I think we all do it. I don't think, you know, I think the human mind's fast. I think we all do it subconsciously anyway. But for me, it's a form of distraction and utilising something rather than going, waking up and going, I'm in pain or I can't do particular things. It's just continue doing. And I think I'm extremely fortunate and able to do it. You know, free education, free laptop down to Tony Blair's era and so forth. And, you know, able to do it and just utilising materials and sense. So whether it's the physical, you know, sort of like two bits of wood or that plastic cup and strawberry, raspberry, whatever that is, nothing against the composition, but I'm just sort of... I do the same thing with the audio and the visuals, with the audios and the visuals. So when I'm splicing these videos up, it's the same thing. It's like, how's that going to connect with that for me? And then it becomes a colour association when I did the tickers, when I did that previous work with the news. You know, if you do five, it doesn't work. So it's how do things relate on the eye? And, you know, the sort of theory of people sitting on the left and the right, what does that sort of mean? When people have been interviewed and stuff. So
are you creating work for yourself or are you creating work that you want people to look at and think either, you know, that's great, I like it, I don't like it, or are you actually inviting people to think in a way that maybe we don't anymore as a society because we think in other ways now because social media has affected what we do, we don't engage with TV or radio in the same way?
I think it's the latter, what you said. I think initially I make it, is it, do I, you know, the critique of, there's this sort of this sort of fire inside myself. It was just to do it, just and so you just start. Excuse me, but obviously I want it to. I don't want to. I'm not trying to tax the viewer because I don't. One of my personal traits is I don't like the idea of art being elitist. So if I'm going to try and be Mr. Clever Clogs within my own self-gratification, then keep it within the bedroom and confined walls. But I want it to relate and I want it to be easy. I don't want it to be taxing for people to go, I don't know this subject. I want it to be open enough for people to explore that subject maybe, or as you said, for people to look at it in a particular way and not to offend the viewer. It's not, I'm not here to, there's enough things going on in the world for them to, you know, if they want to be disappointed, just walk out the door and be disappointed that there's no rubbish being picked up.
Just walk out the door and be disappointed.
My intention is not to add to that, basically. And that is the truth. I'm not trying to offend people or annoy people or be sort of controversial because just let somebody else do that. Mm. That's not my intention. As the lovely Liz Truss said, just reminds me, that was what she said one of her last speeches when she was in the House of Commons. That is not my intention. So, yeah.
Now, we spoke quite a lot about your practice and things that you've done and things that I know you've done. Like you mentioned the ticker tape thing there, which you'd done at the Phoenix, the depot here, actually, many years ago when I interviewed you. And then we've collaborated twice. And then you mentioned this sabotage thing as well about, you know, wearing a balaclava and it like a live performance where you collaborate with people. What does that do to your practice when you're not sitting there with your laptop creating your content, or is actually you're creating this content almost like live in a situation where you're seeing the reaction of people in front? Does it give you something slightly different, or is it a way of forcing yourself to be out there?
Yeah, it came from the sort of the head injuries. I'm sensitive to light and sound, and I was like, I can't be defeated. I've got to be able to sort of. It started with sort of expressing my sort of anger and distaste, but then the balaclava became because it's I don't want to be identified for that. And when I sort of met a few artists with disabilities, I was like, well, it's just like flying the flag. But the idea of the balaclava, full disclosure, is this: it's if I can't be bothered, I'll say, John, do us a favor, put that balaclava on and just. Turn some knobs,
yeah,
and I'll be off having a pint. So it doesn't become a unique ownership of something. Excuse me. And the idea was it was to do with to relate with the audience. So if somebody walks in and how I interpret the way they've walked in, I would create an audio composite or visual composite of my. Satisfaction or dissatisfaction, dependent on how I feel, rather than saying, hey, you are whatever. And then.
So you're using like almost sounds as a way of reacting to how people are entering the room or they're interacting with each other as well.
Yeah.
It's almost like a live reading of the room by like a barometer, isn't it?
Yeah.
This person came in and changed the energy and you're
exactly.
able to reflect that.
Yeah. And that's what. And it goes back to that same thing of it's not this sort of idea of elitism. I'm not a musician, and I've not done film whatever thing at school or whatever. So with that medium, should I say, that I use, I'm not expecting the guy who's walked in and giving him a hard time. It's just that's my limitation of knowing how to be happy or dissatisfied with the way he's walked, or she, or they, or them, or whatever, have walked in. I can try to express something. And it's also, it's almost like this sort of durational thing of how long, it's this, for the love of art, I suppose people say these sort of things, but I'm trying to see the limitation of how long can I last. So 15 minutes is good enough. But any more than that, it's just waffling and just torturous. I think for both the audience and for myself.
Because, so you're being creative, but you're also, it's like part therapy as well, because you're constantly challenging yourself to rise to the situation that presents itself to you at that particular moment.
Exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose it's like a self-help book in a sense. I mean, I remember going through this.
That you're making almost like live in real time as you're going along.
Yeah. And the good thing is it's like... nothing's precious for me. I don't see things as precious apart from sort of the way I've made my cheese on toast. That becomes a precious thing because if I've slightly burnt the bread, slightly annoyed. But with the artwork, it's just a continuation. It seems to end. And also it's, I used to believe sort of early, you know, when I started to understand art, you know, you've got art, politics, and then the other, which for me was art. So you can pretty much express and say everything, and I see that as almost the opposite in today's sort of era with the way things work. So I purposely go back to, I don't think I've ever used Donald Trump in any of my work. I've used Zelensky because he's just comical, and so he works within the medium structure, but I don't do it for this. It's not a shock and awe factor. It's not some sort of Naomi Klein or, you know, all these sort of things. People can read those books and work it out themselves. That's not why I do it, no.
So as we get into the last segment here, I'm going to bring Rob in. Rob, you know, we talk quite a lot about, you know, how the world's changing. You know, you heard Jazz there mentioned Donald Trump, who actually doesn't appear in his work yet, and other characters and stuff. And as the media and journalism and things like that, maybe the written word, the spoken word, gets challenged by censorship or what you can say or not say. Are we going to go back to that sort of the more radical days of art and digital art when it comes to actually that's the only place that you can express this kind of opinion about the world and the state that it's in? It's very deep and existential, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go on, you answer that, we'll have some water.
give me 5 years and I'll come back with an answer. It's or longer. I don't know. Each. I mean, this is the point. Don't put an expectation on art. You know, people have a sense that somehow you should have an answer to the world now and the challenges of the world now. And the point is, that's not what art is about. I mean, I was reflecting on what you're describing, Jazz, in terms of... I saw a really good documentary on YouTube about Prince and about how he just had the floodgates were open. He was constantly being inundated or fed by a creative impulse to do something. He was open to that. And there's very few people are in that situation where you get, you know, it's just constantly all the time doing stuff and you're constantly writing things, you're constantly painting things, you're constantly doing things. And that comes from a particular place, which is that unique gift that or curse that artists have, that there's that element there that you kind of tapped into something. And we've really got to start to not consider them in terms of a transactional response with the moment or the present. It can be that, but it could also be about when you tap into the unconscious like that, you can be projecting to the future or the past in ways that aren't, you know, we still don't know what Blake was writing about and thinking about. We're still interpreting that in that now. That's 200 years later.
So everything is still open for interpretation.
Yeah. And that's the, you know, the interesting thing, what I really like about your approach is that when you have people come in and interface with you in a exhibition or something, it's you very much in a case of kind of seeing what their response is. So you're feeding that back into it as part of the live process. But it brought to mind something that the Velvet Underground, when they used to do the performances with Andy Warhol, and they had a rule which was always leave the audience wanting less. Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's so there's just so many different ways that you can come at it, and what does it mean how it's remembered? It's like, well, you've just got to follow that impulse.
Yeah, I mean, just final thing before we come to you, Jez. I think, you know, my partner Tina, her mum's got had some brain aneurysms and a stroke, so that kind of brain injury type thing, if you like, along the lines of yourself. And to spend any kind of time with her, it's almost like, you know, while I'm talking to you, I'm thinking of a million other things. She doesn't have the filter, so she's like this constant stream of consciousness talking, which kind of really sort of surprises people sitting around her, because she's like, well, why is she saying that out loud? Shouldn't she just be thinking it? Whereas what I like about you and what you do, and why I've really enjoyed as a, you know, someone who's got, you know, independent museums and that kind of stuff, is working with someone who is open and receptive to all of those streams of consciousness from people kind of like walking in the room or what's going on or how people, but you're able to then interpret and show it back in a way that people are like, oh, I didn't think of that. I've never really thought about it. From your ticker tape work through to 1984 through, you know, to what you did for us for Computala, hidden away behind QR codes. But when you watch that, it's like you've taken five films from 2008 and made them completely contemporary in 2025 without changing the original meaning, but actually giving them more context, which is anything ever really new or old? It's always just constantly changing and your own interpretation, and that's what I've enjoyed working with you.
Well, that's a good point, because you made me realise that it's like when I was showing you examples of like little clips I've done before, and it's like, imagine doing that now. You could just keep continuing. It doesn't end. Why should it end? Will it end, or does it even end? And I never really thought of that in that sense, but. Excuse me, for me it's sort of like, it's sort of definitive thing. And I think like what you just said, as soon as you said when you're talking about Blakes and stuff, and I was thinking, yeah, the Bible, you know, I'll pick it up. Well, I don't pick it up every day. There's reasons why I need to use it sometimes. Maybe it's not to actually physically read it, it's just a very good surfer, you know. But you pick it up and you're flicking, you're like, so it's almost like looking at a word every day on a wall, and how I or we. I mean, I'm looking at these books and thinking, I'll come in tomorrow and I'll probably look at them again in a different way. Yeah. So
interpret them in a different way, in a different order.
That's
and stuff.
Like, yeah, and then when you said about Martina, and so, that's the thing with Mind of the Film. It just doesn't end. It's just constant. It's only because we're talking about it. It's just a million different things going on. And when you mentioned about something, you said something about the YouTube thing. I've been thinking about this film called, what's it called? Eye Pencil. And what it means to have a pencil in your hand, how many people die and what goes on, just to have this graphite pencil that we just rub out. And so just that minuscule, that one little item, I could interpret it as, yeah, it's a pencil. It's not a pen, though, is it? You know, but what goes on around the world just for us to have that tool, a writing tool. Yeah.
Brilliant. Jazz, thanks for talking to us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.